Grand Canyon University's RN to BSN online degree program makes earning your bachelor's in nursing possible. Balance online coursework with local in-person clinicals to position yourself for potential leadership opportunities in the time you have from wherever you are, leaving room for what matters. Achieve your goals with your personalized plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hello, and welcome back to Movie Mike's Movie Podcast. I am your host, Movie Mike, and today I want to share with you seven times that composer Hans Zimmer went way too hard on a movie score. I'm going to let you know why. He is my favorite movie composer of all time. In the movie review, we'll be talking about A Haunting in Venice. Was it scary? Was it entertaining? Was it worth my time to go see this movie in theaters because I was on the fence about it? And in the trailer park, we have a new movie with Uma Thurman and Samuel L. Jackson, who have reunited for the first time since the 90s, since they did Pulp Fiction together. We'll talk about The Kill Room. Thank you for being here. Thank you for being subscribed and listening every single week. Shout out to the Monday Morning Movie Crew, and now let's talk movies.
In a world where everyone and their mother has a podcast, one man stands to infiltrate the ears of listeners like never before in a movie podcast. A man with so much movie knowledge, he's basically like a walking IMDb with glasses. From the Nashville Podcast Network, this is Movie Mike's Movie Podcast.
I often think that movie scores get overlooked on how important they are to all of our favorite films. A great movie score can take an 8 film and make it a 10, and it is the foundation of setting the scene, setting the tone, evoking emotion, and it's always just there. It's the glue that holds all these scenes together, and sometimes when it's so good, we just take it for granted. It is there, it is existing, but sometimes you don't take time to think about how impactful the movie score can be on one scene or making an entire movie. And Hans Zimmer is one of the best to do it. He recently celebrated his 66th birthday, and I have been so obsessed with movie scores lately, I decided to dive into the life of Hans Zimmer and realize how impactful his work has been over the years. So on this episode, we're going to take a look at his career and the seven times I think he went way too hard on a movie score. So looking into the life of Hans Zimmer, he was born on September 12th, 1957 in Frankfurt, Germany. He started playing music as a kid, learned how to play the piano, and his breakthrough into the film industry came in the 1980s when he did the score for Rain Man. That's when he developed a relationship with director Brian Levinson and started to get known in Hollywood as being able to create some memorable film scores. One of his most iconic breakthrough works came in 1994 with none other than Disney's The Lion King, which earned him the Oscar for Best Original Score. I think one of the most impressive things about Hans Zimmer is his versatility and his range when it comes to creating film scores, because not only did he do animated movies like The Lion King, he also went on to do movies like Gladiator, The Dark Knight Trilogy, and create these really iconic moments through his music and through his compositions. And I think what really sets his work apart from other composers Rodgers is I feel like at his core, he is just a great musician and knows how to blend a lot of different types of instruments. Sometimes when you think about movie scores, you maybe think more of somebody like a John Williams, who creates these very epic sounding, but more of what you would hear like from an orchestra, which Hans Zimmer also uses those same orchestral elements, but he also blends things like electronic instruments and really has a unique sound that you can tell when it is a Hans Zimmer composition. And I think that's why so many directors go to him, because they know you're really gonna step up my film with your work. And I think that is what he does. It's like getting the Beatles to do the score for your movie. You know it's gonna be a hit if Hans Zimmer is a part of it. And in addition to his work in film, he has also collaborated with a lot of artists like Elton John, Pharrell Williams. So he has done music outside of the film industry, which is another thing that I feel sets him apart. And just by the numbers alone, he has 150 film scores to his name, countless awards. So his two Academy Awards for Best Original Score came in 1994 with The Lion King, which I mentioned earlier, and then again in 2021 with Dune. So now that we know a little bit about Hans Zimmer, let's get into the list. I have 7 different compositions from his movies that I picked, not because they are only from some of my favorite movies, but also because I feel that they show his range, and because hearing these compositions, even on their own, make me want to lose my mind. So at number 7, from 1993's True Romance, the track is called You're So Cool. I feel like this one is a little bit of a non-traditional pick. And going hard doesn't mean it has to come right out of the gate and punch you in the face. I just think the sound of this one is so unique. Listen to it. And the part I love where I feel like, okay, it really goes to another level and goes way too hard is once the percussion kicks in. This one is going to be much different than the rest on this list, but I wanted to show you his range. And in a movie that I wouldn't even classify as one of my favorites from the 90s, I remember this song, and it's so distinct and so memorable and uses so many different types of instruments that I feel like in that one, his creativity just went too hard. So at number 7, I have You're So Cool from True Romance. At number 6, from 2017, the movie is Dunkirk, and the track is called Supermarine. I love this movie. We're looking now at the work of Hans Zimmer and Christopher Nolan, a match made in heaven. They are peanut butter and jelly. They will make more appearances on this list. But what I loved about Dunkirk and the score, and this track specifically, is it really elevates all the action, because that movie is not only visually stunning, but it requires a score like this to really bring home that emotion and to show you the tenacity of everything on the line in that movie and show you war from an entirely different perspective. And in that movie, it's very bright and colorful, but also very dark and gritty at the same time. A lot of emphasis on the blues and the green, but it just has like this dirty filter to put you into the perspective of these soldiers. And underneath that, the glue that holds it all together is Hans Zimmer's score to really bring home that emotion. And I think he went way too hard on this track specifically. I love his buildups like this, building that tension, letting you know that something not good is about to happen. But my favorite thing in the work of Hans Zimmer are the drops. And this one is so delicious. Ah, I can feel it. Listen to all those different types of instruments and the percussion. It sounds like madness, and I want to know what is going on in his brain while composing something like this. And then you pair that with this movie, oh, it is beautiful. So at number 6, we have Dunkirk. Moving on to number 5 is a movie from 2010. It's called Inception, and this track specifically is called Dream is Collapsing. There are so many great scenes in Inception that are made just that much better with the work of Hans Zimmer. And I think the music in this movie was so influential to the 2010s. I feel like after this movie, everybody wanted the style of Inception when it came to the visuals, but also when it came to the sound, specifically the drone sound, which I feel ran rampant in the 2010s. And it was all because of Inception. It's that horn drone effect that ended up being in every single movie trailer in the 2010s. This one right here. That was in every single trailer, and it was all because of Inception. But along with those sound effects, it was the score from Inception, and this one just went way too hard. Charging. See, I love the fact that it has that big orchestra sound, but then you also get that charging, almost electronic sound. And I feel like you could almost put anything on screen and this be epic. I could just put this song on my Instagram story and it would be epic. It could just be me eating a piece of, like, I don't know, raw tofu. And it's still epic. But also, I love the scene wherever it is showing the relationship between Leonardo DiCaprio and his wife. And it's so soft and emotional. And I feel like this is going hard in a different way because it's not so much on the big epic sound of Hans Zimmer, but it's that sweet, delicate sound. And knowing that sometimes less is more, and I think that is also a very important quality to creating a memorable score. Stripping away all the things and just focusing on the emotion, because there's no dialogue in this scene. It's all held together through the performances of the actors and this song. So essentially, the music is a character in itself. So we went too hard on this entire soundtrack. At number 5, it is Inception. At number 4 is an animated movie from 1994 that we mentioned earlier, the one he won the Academy Award for Best Score. It is The Lion King. The song is To Die For / What Have You Done. It's the scene in the movie after Mufasa dies. And then Scar comes up to Simba and tells him, "What have you done? You killed your father." And then he tells him to run before he gets chased by the hyenas. A really memorable scene that comes after a depressing moment because it's right after the sad moment of him losing his dad and now having to run for his life. And then Hans Zimmer just went way too hard on the composition for the scene. Like how insane that is. This track sounds so expensive. Like, listen to all of those instruments and the vocals on this. Like, Disney was probably just like, "Hey, we just need some music to show that Simba is being chased." Hans Zimmer, he's like, "All right, hold this. I got you." It is epic. It is memorable. It is at number 4. Hans Zimmer's work on The Lion King. Moving on to number 3 from 2021, it is Dune, and it's the theme song. And I am a big fan of all the cinematic qualities of Dune. I didn't entirely love the movie. I'm more anticipated for the sequel because that is what I'm being told and reading, that that's where all the action is. I thought Dune looked great and sounded great, but the overall story and character development in that movie wasn't really for me, but it does feel very epic and looks amazing on screen. But what I can't deny is the theme song to Dune and how unnecessarily hard it goes, starting out from the very opening of the track. Like that instrumentation there, the building of the tension. Oh, and the vocal comes in. Like, that is memorable right there. Maybe channeling a little bit of The Lion King from his work earlier. But that is something unique. And that is something that is really gonna set your film apart. That is why you pay him millions of dollars to do the score. But then, of course, it also has the patented Hans Zimmer drop. Takes it to an entirely different level. This one makes me want to run through a wall. I'm gonna run through a wall right now! And that is why it is at number 3, the soundtrack to Dune. At number 2 is from 2014. The film is Interstellar, and it's another theme song. This one is a little bit more delicate, but like I was saying earlier, sometimes less is more. And this score is so intricate and so memorable and so gentle and beautiful that he went unnecessarily hard to make us all cry with the score to Inception, because paired with Matthew McConaughey's performance and the emotional ferocity of this movie, oh my gosh, it gets me emotional just thinking about it. But listen to this score. Like that first note, just that first note makes me want to bawl my eyes out like Matthew McConaughey in that one scene we all know. There's some other great moments in this soundtrack as well. Again, just so delicate, so beautiful. It's like he's creating these memorable scores that don't even need the movie to exist. They're just great music on their own. Like, this is one soundtrack that if I just needed to mellow out and listen to some music to have on in the background, this is what I would put on. And of course, you get the Hans Zimmer drop. The building, I think on this performance specifically, he's playing guitar, just going on those notes. And I think that, at the core of it, he is a musician who just loves performing too. And this score just really shows that. Don't do it to us, Hans! Like, I feel like at his core, he just wants to rock out. Maybe he wanted to be a rock star. You really hear it there. But maybe like me, he is too much of a nerd to be a rock star. So I'll just create these epic scores to films instead. Ugh. But at number 2, we have Inception. Before we get to number 1, I do have some honorable mentions. The Last Samurai is also some of his best work. This is A Way of Life from The Last Samurai. We also have Now We Are Free from Gladiator. And one of my favorites, another one of his delicate tracks, 2049 from Blade Runner 2049. Like, this one is so experimental, it almost made my number 7 slot. How epic is that? And another one that almost made the list, but it's not one of his official credits, because although he did write this theme, it did have a different composer. But from 2003, Pirates of the Caribbean and the Curse of the Black Pearl, this one goes so hard. But it's just not one of his official credits. We have made it to number 1. The best example of Hans Zimmer going way too hard is from 2008, The Dark Knight. The track is Why So Serious, goes into Like a Dog Chasing Cars. What he did with the entire Dark Knight trilogy was amazing. And I think specifically in The Dark Knight, because anytime the Joker was on screen, you knew it because of the music. It got a little bit more intense. It got a little bit more violent. It sounded like there was more on the line every time the Joker was on screen. So not only was it seeing Heath Ledger, but it was also hearing the music that invoked that emotion in all of us. Whether you realized it or not, the music was so essential to creating that gritty tone of Gotham and really setting that movie apart from all the other Batman movies, where you had, you know, epic tracks too from Danny Elfman, but it takes it up on an entirely different level when it's a little bit more sophisticated, a little bit more of an orchestra sound, but also this very driving, pounding sound. To me, it's like orchestra punk rock. I don't know if that's a genre specifically, because that is the only way I can think of describing the score in The Dark Knight. That is it. That is seven times that Hans Zimmer went way too hard. What is your favorite Hans Zimmer score? I mean, for me, it's the one we just heard, The Dark Knight. There's so many elements going on there. It's so memorable. I love it all. We'll come back. I'll give you my movie review of A Haunting in Venice. And then in the trailer park, we'll be talking about The Kill Room after this.
Bean Dad, The Dress. 30 to 50 feral hogs. If you knew what any of those were, you spend too much time online. And hey, I do too. 16th Minute of Fame is a new weekly podcast hosted by me, Jamie Loftus, where every week I take a closer look at an internet character of the day. Who were they? What made them so notorious? Why did the internet choose them? And what does a person do when they're suddenly confronted with more attention than the human psyche can handle? I'll be talking to internet historians, experts, and yes, the main characters themselves to get a fuller picture. Because I think that even outside individual experiences, a character of the day tells us something about how the internet worked at that time and how the attention economy developed into the freaky three-headed dragon it is today. Together, we probably won't be able to properly log out, but we can take a walk down scary internet memory lane and see one day a little more clearly. Listen to 16th Minute of Fame on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together. We'll cry together and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's get into a spoiler-free movie review now, talking about A Haunting in Venice. It's part of a franchise that has had some odd success, even though really I've only liked one of the films so far. So it's a part of the franchise that includes Murder on the Orient Express, Death on the Nile, and now we have A Haunting in Venice. It's supposed to be the spooky one. Now that we're getting into spooky season at the movies, they wanted to cash in on what if we do the same kind of murder mystery, but now with a bit of a supernatural horror-esque. It's really like diet horror. Ooh, not even close to that. It's like horror adjacent because you have Kenneth Branagh, who also directs and stars in these movies. He plays the detective, who is the same detective throughout all of the films. This story takes place in 1947. He is retired. He is done being a detective, but somebody pulls him back in. You have Tina Fey's character, who is trying to write a new book after having three failed books. She heard this story about a woman whose daughter died from suicide, and they want to go check it out and get the details. So they go to a séance where they try to communicate with the daughter who passed away, and then everything hits the fan, and then everything gets scary because they are in this building that is supposedly haunted by children who want to kill again. Now, I enjoyed Death on the Nile because I went into it with very low expectations. On the surface level of these movies, there really isn't anything spectacular, nothing to really write home about, but they are pretty entertaining. What's different about these movies and the reason you could keep making these with a revolving cast of characters is because you don't go to this movie for the A-list star. The format of this movie is the star. It's the whodunit scenario. Same formula as the two previous movies. He goes, somebody dies, he has to figure out how that person dies, and then goes through all this investigation of asking all these people different questions, finding out where they were, just like you would in the game of Clue. So this is kind of reintroducing what they already did with these movies back in the day to a whole new generation, and I think it works. But I think it's really for people who are so into murder dramas and investigations. This movie is kind of like NCIS because the action isn't really hardcore. The horror, it really isn't scary whatsoever. There are some jump scare moments because really loud noises come out of nowhere. So that will get you. But as far as creepy visuals or any blood and death, it's very PG-13. So you wouldn't have any worry of going to see this movie and having nightmares afterwards unless you just really don't do well whatsoever with any horror elements. But I feel like an 8-year-old could watch this movie and have no problem falling asleep at night. I went into this movie differently than I did Death on the Nile. Death on the Nile, I had really low expectations and ended up enjoying it pretty well. This one, since I liked that one, I had a little bit higher expectations because I knew what the format was going to be. I just knew that it was going to be naturally engaging because you're trying to figure it out just like the detective is in this movie. And there's some fun element to that. It becomes a game to try and figure it out and put all the pieces together. But I have to say in this one, really lacked creativity, really lacked a lot of imagination. It was so focused on making it scary and never really got there that it took away from the plot developing and making you question different things going on in the movie. And at times, it just felt really boring that I'm always invested in a movie like this because I want to figure out who did it and I want to be right. That is it. I watch these movies and I want to have it right within the first 20 minutes because that is just how I am. I feel like this was the most predictable out of all these movies because they were so focused on making it scary. They've left out making it engaging and making it entertaining. So I really struggled just to want to pay attention and want to see the result of this movie because it was just lackluster. And the other problem with the format of the movie being the star is it's really hard for any of the actors to shine because I feel like they are so restricted that nobody really gets a chance to shine and show off what great of an actor they are because you have Michelle Yeoh in this, who is probably the most standout performance, but then you have Tina Fey, who I was excited to see, and her performance really wasn't great whatsoever, but I think it was because she was trying to play this character in 1947, but the entire time period fell off, so her entire character, I felt, was a little bit wasted. And then you have Kenneth Branagh, who is starring in this movie and also directing it. And I have to say, it really shows in this movie because there's not a whole lot of great direction with all the cast. And there's also not a really great performance from him, which he is so good in all the other movies. And I couldn't help But compare it to Knives Out and Knives Out Glass Onion, because Daniel Craig does a great job of playing such a great lead in that, that I feel like the star of that movie is him, and it's not just the format of that, because I would just watch it for his character, the way he talks, the way he figures things out, and the way his mind works. In this movie, Kenneth Branagh really didn't do that whatsoever. So I would say after the first 20, maybe 25 minutes of this movie, it really started to go downhill. It did start out with a little bit of promise with Michelle Yeoh's character organizing the seance and some of the things that happened early on in the film, but everything throughout never really got back there. The entire movie just had a really weird tone and even a lack of music, because there were scenes they were trying to let breathe and let you live in that creepiness of the house, but it was just silent to the point where it was boring. I needed a score there. I needed some music. I needed some more things happening in this movie to make me want to get to the finale. Surprisingly, this movie is doing pretty well, given that it had a $60 million budget. We went to see this on a Friday night, and it was surprisingly packed. Primarily an older audience, which again, goes back to me thinking that people who love NCIS also love movies like this. And I don't want to hate anybody for enjoying this movie. I think the format of it is fine. This one just didn't really win me over. But I could see them definitely making a fourth movie, and they've even said if Kenneth Branagh is down to do another one, if there's another story to be told, there will be a fourth installment inside of this franchise. I hope they get away completely from making anything creepy and go back to something like Death on the Nile, where there's more that goes on in the location, because I think that's really what ended up hurting this movie in the end. Because Death on the Nile, they're on the boat, but they also had several stops along the way for more things to happen. This one just felt so boring. It felt like a bottle episode from TV where they didn't want to spend a whole lot on a lot of different locations. They just stay in this place the entire time, and it just feels kind of boring and empty and shallow. So at the moment of recording this, the movie has made $71 million worldwide. It may continue to rise going into October and people wanting to watch something somewhat scary or creepy at least. So I would say, go to see this movie if you just love murder whodunit movies, or if you have somebody in your life who doesn't like scary movies whatsoever, and you just kind of want to wade them into those waters of maybe possibly getting to take them to see The Exorcist later on. I don't really think there's anything worth it in this movie to have to see it in theaters. Definitely wait for it to come onto streaming services, because I think it's worthy of a stream, especially if you haven't seen all the other movies inside of the franchise. Maybe just knock them out in a weekend. Otherwise, you can definitely wait for this one. So for A Haunting in Venice, I wanted to give it like a 3. My expectations were not met whatsoever. So I am going to give it 2 out of 5 seances.
Bean Dad, The Dress, 30 to 50 Feral Hogs. If you knew what any of those were, you spend too much time online. And hey, I do too. 16th Minute of Fame is a new weekly podcast hosted by me, Jamie Loftus, where every week I take a closer look at an internet character of the day. Who were they? What made them so notorious? Why did the internet choose them? And what does a person do when they're suddenly confronted with more attention than the human psyche can handle? I'll be talking to internet historians, experts, and yes, the main characters themselves to get a fuller picture. Because I think that even outside individual experiences, a character of the day tells us something about how the internet worked at that time and how the attention economy developed into the freaky three-headed dragon it is today. Together, we probably won't be able to properly log out, but we can take a walk down scary internet memory lane and see one day a little more clearly. Listen to 16th Minute of Fame on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to talk about and go through all the things that are sometimes difficult to process alone. We're going to go over how to regulate your emotions, diving deep into holistic personal development, and just building your mindset to have a happier, healthier life. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed change my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
And basically have conversations that can help us get through this crazy thing we call life.
I already believe in myself. I already see myself. And so when people give me an opportunity, I'm just like, oh, great, you see me too.
We'll laugh together, we'll cry together, and find a way through all of our emotions. Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's time to head down to Movie Mike's Trailer Park.
Two of my favorite actors are teaming up for the first time in 30 years. Talking about Uma Thurman and Samuel L. Jackson, who both starred in the movie from 1994, Pulp Fiction. They are back in a movie called The Kill Room, which is a dark comedy slash crime thriller movie. And one that's kind of going under the radar right now. It's already coming out in theaters this Friday, depending on when you're listening to this episode, September 29th. And it just reminds me that so many things are out of whack right now with the writer's strike and people not being able to promote their projects. We have to get that thing figured out and we have to get those people paid. We were on such a great trajectory of movies doing so well after the pandemic that this is really starting to halt things. So get our writers paid, get our actors paid, get everybody who is out of work right now because of the strike paid, because I want to see more movies like this succeed, because the premise of this movie is great. It has an awesome cast because not only do you have two of my favorite actors back together again, but you also have Uma Thurman and her daughter Maya Hawke starring in their very first film together. So mother and daughter on screen together. This is a great moment in cinematic history. The movie is about Uma Thurman's character, who is an art gallery owner, and she's struggling a little bit. And then she gets involved with this money laundering scheme with this mob to try and help her struggling business. And it looks like there's going to be a little bit of a twist, just what I'm taking away from this trailer. But before I get into more details, here's a little bit of the Kill Room trailer.
So from now on, there's a contract out. I suggest they buy art.
Art? What the frig do you know about art?
This classy art gallery run by this young lady will take a reasonable cut for herself and cut us a nice clean check. This thing that looks like a Smurfwood diarrhea can sell for $1 million, and the IRS wouldn't bat an eye.
So Samuel L. Jackson plays this mob boss, and he has this assassin that he is working with, and they need to find a way to clean their money because they're taking payment for these people he is killing, but they can't use that money because the IRS can track it back to them. So they find Uma Thurman's character, who has this struggling art gallery, and the assassin starts making these really awful paintings, giving them to her to sell, and she takes a cut of the profits. But then what happens? It seems like his art starts to become popular. He creates this artist nickname that he goes by, kind of like a Banksy character, which is kind of the situation you have going on in this movie. And I feel like it's a bit of a commentary and maybe even a reflection of what actually happens in real life. And I guess I've had this suspicion, call it a conspiracy theory, if you will, but I've always kind of thought that as much as I love art and can appreciate it, sometimes I see some artwork and I can't believe how much it sells for. So in the back of my mind, I'm always just looking at art, or really any kind of business. Like, how do they operate? How do they stay open? I drive by a lamp store every day on my way home, and I think, who's going in there and buying lamps to keep the lights on in this facility? I feel the same way sometimes about art, of how can you sell this painting that to me looks like just a normal painting, but it's worth $1 to $2 million. Now, I feel a lot of this is based on the artist and based on the story behind it. So if there is a demand for it, you can create this buzz and create this price that somebody is willing to pay that amount. Because it seems like in the movie, they get a client and instead of paying them for the hit, they buy this artwork from the gallery, from this assassin, and then it looks like it's a clean, done deal. But what they don't expect is his artwork to actually get popular and people who have no idea about this operation just start buying the art because there's a buzz around it. It also kind of reminds me of what happened just a couple of years ago with NFTs going on sale. And everybody was buying these really expensive NFTs and trying to classify and explain to us exactly what made them so valuable and how there was a limited space in the digital world too. So these things were going to hold their value. And I just read this study that examined over 73,000 NFT collections and found that 95% of them may now be worthless. So it's just odd timing that this movie is coming out right now. I'm just excited to see Uma Thurman and Maya Hawke on screen together. I think that dynamic is interesting. Some people may issue a nepotism alert. And yes, you have two really talented and well-connected parents with Uma Thurman and Ethan Hawke. But I also think Maya Hawke has a lot of talent. I loved her in Stranger Things. I also loved her in Netflix's Do Revenge. So I think there is a lot there that I'm not screaming nepotism if we actually get somebody who is worth the crap right now. I also just love the fact that Samuel L. Jackson is still just cranking out movies. He has been in over 170 films. I feel like if he is in it, it just takes it up to a different level. Minus Secret Invasion. That was not a great Marvel show. So if I had to share my excitement level after watching this trailer, let's see. On a scale of 1 through 5, I'm about a 4 for this movie. Mainly because prior to sitting down and watch this trailer, I didn't really hear or know much about the plot. And right after I finished it, I thought, I gotta see this movie now. Oh, it just happens to be coming out on Friday. Perfect timing. So I'm about a 4 out of 5. I'm also just holding on to hope that Uma Thurman busts out some of her Kill Bill moves. The movie is called The Kill Room and it comes out this Friday, September 29th.
And that was this week's edition of Movie Minds Trailer Park.
And that's going to do it for another episode here of the podcast. Before I go, I got to give my listener shout out of the week. This week, I'm going over to my TikTok, which I just had one kind of pop off out of nowhere. So if you don't follow me on TikTok, what are you doing? I'm there at Mike Distro on every social media platform as Mike Distro. This week, I am shouting out Rene Ramos, who commented on my Nun 2 review and said, "Your voice is growing, brother. Keep up the great work." Thank you, Rene. Thank you for listening and watching my review. I feel like over time, I've just gotten more dialed into who I am and who I want to be and what I want to say and how I want to do my reviews. I will honestly tell you right now, early on, I was so concerned with what people were going to think of my opinions, and I wanted to be like a well-renowned critic. And sometimes I felt like I needed to have a certain view to be seen as legitimate. And I realized after the years of doing this podcast, I just have to say how I feel and say it the way I want to say it, even if it makes me look or sound dumb, because it's just genuine to me and genuine to my emotions. So I feel like oddly I've backed my way into finding this newfound confidence. So thank you, Rene, for realizing and shouting that out. So you shout me out, I shout you out back. Thank you for listening. Hope you're subscribed at this point. If you're not, what are you doing? If you haven't told a friend about this podcast who also loves movies, what are you doing? Get on that. Thank you to the movie crew. Until next time, go out and watch good movies, and I will talk to you later.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, "Well, I had this career before, but it was a waste." And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce.
Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Every family has an origin story, one passed down through the generations. Mine happens to be a mystery involving my great-great-grandmother left behind in Sicily. I'm Joe Piazza, and my new podcast will transport you to the gorgeous island of Sicily as I trace my roots back through a whodunit for the ages. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.